Welcome to everyone gathered here in this place and to everyone watching and listening online. As always, it's good for us to be together in this way. We are continuing our journey through 1 and 2 Samuel, which, as you know, focuses mostly on the life of David, who was a shepherd boy who then grew to be this mighty and famous king. And in 2 Samuel chapter 5, in the neighborhood of where we will be today, in 2 Samuel chapter 5, David finally becomes the king of all the tribes of Israel. And his first act of king, as king, is to go and conquer the city of Jerusalem and take it away from the Jebusites and make it his capital city. It will now be known as the City of David. And then he and his army go out and fight the Philistines and take back all the land that King Saul had lost in the final days of his reign. So at the beginning of 2 Samuel chapter 6, David has established his kingdom. Things are going very well for him and the people and the land. And so David decides that he wants to bring to Jerusalem, his capital city, named after him, the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Lord, the most sacred object in the faith of Israel, representing and symbolic of God's very presence among his people. David wants it to be there in the city with him, not only, I'm sure, to honor God, but also to fortify his new reign. But first he has to retrieve it from the house of Abinadab, where the ark had been kept for years after the Philistines returned it to Israel on a cart after having a very bad experience with it in 1 Samuel chapter 5 and 6. And this brings us to one of the most troubling stories in all the Bible, one that raises for me far more questions than it answers. So let's pick it up, 2 Samuel chapter 6, verse 3. They set the ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the ark of God on it, and Ahio was walking in front of it. David and all Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord with sopranos and altos and tenors and basses. It's a paraphrase of the original language. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen stumbled. And then the Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of the irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down and he died there beside the ark of God. As we have been working through these messy details and scenes and stories in 1 and 2 Samuel, you may have gotten the impression that God doesn't really care about the details. That if God is on your side and God has chosen to be with you, then you can pretty much do whatever you want and get away with it. And just as these impressions are beginning to build some serious momentum in 2 Samuel, the storyteller throws this little scene in to remind us that, yes, God does care about the details. And no, you cannot get away with just about anything. Can you imagine how awkward that moment must have been? Everyone's celebrating. It's a party. Uzzah falls over dead. I'm sure David is like, oh, come on, man. We had a good thing going here. And at first glance, Uzzah's death makes very little sense. He was just trying to help. But as they say, no good deed goes unpunished. And he gets zapped by the Lord as if he has touched a live wire that is buzzing with electricity. I wonder what Uzzah was thinking when he reached out to steady the ark. I bet he wasn't thinking at all. It was an automatic reflex, an instinctive reaction that had been conditioned in him over the course of his life since he was a little boy. Please let me explain, or at least let me speculate, because nobody really knows for sure. But the text tells us that Uzzah was the son of Abinadab. Abinadab, in whose house the ark of the Lord was kept for years. Uzzah grew up with the ark of the Lord, the most sacred object in Israel, in the back room of his house. He was raised to be a caretaker of the ark of the Lord. He managed and protected God's box, which for him somewhere along the way became synonymous with God. God's box became Uzzah's God in the box, a box that Uzzah was quite comfortable managing. For Uzzah, familiarity does not breed contempt, it breeds complacency. And maybe that's why he and his brother, when it's time to transport the ark, they put it on a cart. At least it was a new cart, but it's a cart. And they transport it Philistine style. Instead of having the priests carry the ark by running poles through the rings on the side of the ark as prescribed by the law of Moses. And when that oxen tripped and the cart tipped, I envision Uzzah casually putting his hand on the ark of the Lord. He was doing his job. He was protecting. He was managing. He was taking care of his God in the box. And God turns complacent, casual, irreverent Uzzah into an object lesson, reminding everyone in Israel, including David, who wants God's box in his capital city, that God will not be put in a box that you can easily manage or control or that needs to be taken care of by human beings. One way of reading Uzzah's death, and there's more than one way, but one way of reading his death is that it is a warning against exchanging a dynamic relationship with a holy and living and mysterious God for a more easily controlled and managed box of casual, predictable, ho-hum religion. David, on the other hand, is not religious. He has a dynamic relationship with the living God. And when Uzzah falls over dead, David's response is not religious. It's real. First he gets angry, then he's afraid, and then he goes home and pouts because God ruined his big day. Come on, man. Several months later, though, David decides to try again. This time, the priests carry the ark. And we rejoin the story in verse 12. So David went to bring up the ark from the house of Obed-Edom, where they left it after the disaster, to the city of David with rejoicing. And when those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken six steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. Wearing a linen ephod, David was dancing before the Lord with all his might, while he and all Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. I'm sure the mood at the beginning of the second parade was a little different than the casual mood at the beginning of the first parade. Can you imagine being the priest selected to carry the ark this time? Sure, the first couple of steps were the hardest. One, two, three. 3. After 6 steps, they offer a sacrifice. Ah, we're okay. And you might think, because of Uzzah, everyone would be timid, walking on eggshells all the way to Jerusalem until they placed the ark in the special tent that David had pitched for it. But that's not the way this goes down at all. Instead, once they establish that, yes, they are carrying the ark correctly according to the will of the Lord, they are free to celebrate before the Lord with all their might. David dances before the Lord. Never been much of a dancer myself. Does not come naturally to me. Years ago, Heather and I took a dance class with some friends. I know, son. Midway through the first lesson, the instructor walks by and says to me, "Move in step with the beat." I said, "What beat?" He said, "Go home." I said, "I can't help it. I was raised in the Church of Christ." He says, "I can tell. Please leave my class." I don't know if David was a good dancer or not, but I know he was not a shy dancer. Have you ever been so overwhelmed in a moment of worship? So overcome with the love and the faithfulness of God? So filled with joy in response to God's blessing that you turn it loose and dance as if no one is watching? Yeah, I didn't think so. Neither have I. We come by it honestly. Many of us were raised in churches where we were trained to be suspicious of anyone who acted as if they were enjoying worship too much. And even now, we're still kind of stuck. Our clapping is so sad. You all try. I know you do. A couple of years ago, I saw someone tapping his toe. I thought, oh, we're making progress. No, he was squashing a bug. It's just so hard, isn't it, to let go and turn loose and dance and celebrate. Well, not for David. Yeah, now I've said before, we don't necessarily want to imitate everything David does, but isn't this one of those characteristics, David, you're like, I don't know that I want to do it, but I am kind of jealous that he can do it. He loses himself in the moment. And he dances as if no one is watching. But when you're the king, someone is always watching. In verse 16, it says, "As the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart." Michal, the daughter of Saul, who, remember, is also David's first wife. And David is her first husband. And when they were first married, Michal loved David. The storyteller never says that David loved her, but she loved David. So much so that she helps him escape the wrath of her father, King Saul, when Saul wants to kill him. And then when David is a fugitive, Saul gives his daughter, Michal, away to another man in marriage to spite David. And then after Saul's death and David is battling with Saul's son for the throne, David requests, or actually demands, that Michal, the daughter of Saul, his first wife, be brought back to him, not because he loved her, but because he paid an exorbitant price for her. At least 100 Philistines thought it was an exorbitant price. And that brings up this sad, pitiful scene in 2 Samuel chapter 3. So Ish-bosheth gave orders and had Michal taken away from her husband, her second husband, Paltiel, son of Laish. And her husband, however, went with her, weeping behind her all the way to Bahurim. And then Abner, Saul's general, major tough guy, said to him, "Go back home." So he went back. Michael was passed around as a political pawn by powerful men. And she was taken away from the one man, perhaps the only man, who ever really loved her. But yeah, she doesn't feel like celebrating. She doesn't have any love in her heart left for David. And normally, in sermons like this, Michael is cast as the judgmental villain who criticizes the Lord's anointed as he dances before his king. But knowing her backstory reminds me that our harshest, loudest, most judgmental of critics are often coming from places of deep hurt, heartbreak, and disappointment. It doesn't make their criticism just, doesn't make it any easier to receive, but it does at least put it in context. Hurt people often hurt people. Hurt people hurt people. And after this parade, Michael confronts the king, her husband, when he comes home, and the results are not pretty. Chapter 6, verse 20, when David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, going around half naked in full view of the slave girls of his servants, as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father, knife to the heart, or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." Doesn't this sound like a happy marriage? And then we're told, final line of the scene, and Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. And the storyteller doesn't explain why she has no children. Does God punish her for criticizing the Lord's anointed? Or is this confrontation, does it bring an end to the marital intimacy between David and Michal? We simply don't know why she has no more children. But in that world, in that culture, in that time, it was a disastrous outcome for Michal. And I can't help but see her as yet another casualty in the messiness of David's story. A story that, as I said, keeps raising questions without necessarily supplying answers. This is not one of those stories in the Bible that I can tie up in a nice, neat bow at the end of a sermon. No, this is one of those troubling stories that demands we sit with it for a while and let the questions it raises poke and prod and nudge us where we need to go toward greater appreciation of God's holiness or deeper compassion for our critics or expanded freedom in how we respond to God. So at the risk of oversimplifying and overmoralizing some of the details in this story, I invite you to consider with whom you most identify in this story. Do you identify with Uzzah? Have you put God in a religious box that is easier for you to control and to manage? Has familiarity, and some of us have grown up going to sacred worship gatherings like this our entire lives. Has your familiarity bred not contempt, but complacency? Have you exchanged a dynamic relationship with a holy and living and mysterious and unpredictable God with a box of casual, ho-hum religion? Or do you identify with Michael? Are you channeling your pain, legitimate pain, into criticizing and judging others in the way they worship? Can you imagine letting go of your bitterness toward those who have hurt you and opening your heart to the healing power and transforming power of God's love? Can you imagine not being angry all the time, but instead enjoying the grace of God? Or do you identify with David, or would you like to identify with David? Alive to the presence of God. Open to whatever it is God is doing in your life and ready to celebrate whenever God blesses you. Losing yourself in worship. Turning loose, letting go, and dancing before the Lord with all your might as if no one is watching. Would you like to have a little more of that in your life? To the Uzzas among us, may God awaken us to God's holiness. May we become more aware of the awesome power that is at work in this world, that is at work in the lives of people around us, that is at work within us, and that certainly is at work when we come together as a church. May we never take God's presence among us for granted again. May we never see a gathering like this as just a piece of ho-hum, predictable, controllable, manageable, oh, it's tipping, let's steady it, we don't want it to be embarrassing, religion. To the Michaels among us, may God give us the grace we need to forgive those who have hurt us and mistreated us. And may God set us free from our anger and our bitterness so that we can enjoy and celebrate God's grace, God's work in our lives, God's faithfulness. In spite of our heartbreak. And to the Davids, or the wannabe Davids among us, may God set our hearts free from worrying about what other people around us think about us while we're worshiping. And may God give us such a fresh vision and a fresh experience of salvation and joy that we don't care what other people think of us. And may God set our feet free to dance as if no one is watching. Let's stand and dance. I'm sorry, let's stand and sing.